From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, linguist and essayist John McWhorter on anti-intellectualism and the cult of victimology in the African-American community. McWhorter is the author of Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America. His new book is called The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. Also on the six-month anniversary of the attack on the World Trade Center, we talked to photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's been taking pictures at Ground Zero since a few days after the attacks. Now he's on an international tour with an exhibit of those photos, sponsored by the State Department. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New York City is marking 6 months since the attacks that destroyed the twin towers of the World Trade Center. The commemoration began this morning with 2 moments of silence, marking the moments when planes flew into each of the towers. Later, Mayor Michael Bloomberg dedicated a memorial to the victims, a sculpture that was recovered from the twin towers' debris. Just now, at dusk, the city illuminated a tribute in light. NPR's Jackie Leiden is at the scene. Jackie, tell us what you're seeing.
Well, Corey, what I see are two incredibly splendid and graceful columns of light coming into the sky as far as your eye can see. And, you know, what's interesting is that we thought that these columns of light, I did anyway, would be separated from each other as the original trade towers were. But in the end, they merge into infinity together, which I think the way a lot of people are feeling, looking at these, the sense of merging into the beyond. It's quiet, but reverential. When the switch was thrown, people broke out into applause. There are many boats out on the river. They all sounded their horns, and it's a very beautiful evening here in New York.
Was there a single moment when this light leapt into the sky? I mean, was it one of those breathless things where people just respond?
There was. In fact, I was getting worried. They had just lit one light as a sort of rehearsal, this kind of diaphanous little glow, and I thought, that's not quite the magnificence that I'd been expecting. And then a few minutes later, a 12-year-old girl named Valerie Webb, whose father was a Port Authority policeman, through the switch, and these things just leaped into the sky.
Thank you. Jackie Leiden at the site of New York City's Tribute of Light. 6 months after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, the Bush administration is taking additional steps to cut off funding for terrorist networks. The administration says it will block the assets of several branches of a Muslim charitable foundation based in Saudi Arabia. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Since September 11th, the U.S. claims to have identified 191 individuals or groups it suspects of bankrolling terrorism. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill said the move to block the assets of the organization Al-Hirman came after the government determined money from the foundation's offices in Bosnia and Somalia has been diverted to terrorist activities.
Misusing charity funds to support terrorism harms the people who gave the donation, harms the people who should have received it, and is dangerous to us all.
Al-Hirman's U.S. arm said it was shocked and dismayed by the government's announcement.
NPR's Jack Speer. In stocks today, the Dow gained 38 points. This is NPR News from Washington. Comedian David Letterman said today that he'll stay with CBS rather than accepting an offer to move to a slot on ABC. Letterman's contract with CBS runs out this summer, and the network failed to negotiate a new one during its option period. ABC then let it be known that it would give Letterman the slot now occupied by Ted Koppel's Nightline program if he'd leave CBS. The deals offered by both networks were reportedly worth more than $30 million a year. Union workers at Lockheed Martin plants in West Virginia and Mississippi have walked off the job in a show of support for striking Lockheed Martin employees in Georgia. Mike Savage reports from Georgia Public Radio.
Most of the 2,700 union workers at the Marietta, Georgia aircraft plant voted to go on strike, turning down a 3-year contract that included better pay and a signing bonus. The International Association of Machinists said the contract did not address the main issue of job security. Now union workers at 2 other Lockheed Martin aircraft assembly plants have hit the picket lines in a show of support for the striking Georgia workers. At a plant near Clarksburg, West Virginia, 57 of 65 workers walked off the job, all but shutting down the assembly line. And in Meridian, Mississippi, dozens of machinists went on strike, even though they voted to accept the company's latest contract offer. The Marietta plant produces the F-22 Raptor fighter and the C-130J transport plane. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has requested information from WorldCom Incorporated. The big telecommunications group said it would cooperate with the SEC's request for information that included its accounting procedures and loans made to WorldCom officers. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the James Irvine Foundation, supporting NPR's West Coast expansion, www.irvine.org, partners in building a better California.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John McWhorter, writes thought-provoking, often controversial essays about race. He's the author of the book Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America. In this book, he explained why he thinks that white racism is no longer the main obstacle to black success and achievement. He blames the cult of victimology, the emphasis on separatism, and a strain of anti-intellectualism within the African-American community for holding back African-Americans. McWhorter is African-American and has also written a book about American English and the debate over Ebonics called Word on the Street. He's an associate professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book is called The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. One of his linguistic interests is Ebonics. He sees African American English as a very rich dialect, a precious national creation. I asked him about his interest in African American dialect.
Well, in general, my linguistic work has not focused on that particular dialect, and that's because I've always been interested in the exotic, and for rather obvious reasons, black English is not exotic to me. That's what I grew up hearing relatives and friends speak. But when the Ebonics controversy came up, I felt moved to put in my 2 cents because it was clear that the United States thought of black English as bad speech. And it's understandable why people think that, because we're trained to think that standard English is the English and everything else is a departure from it. But in fact, if a Martian came down and the first person they met was a fluent speaker of black English or Ebonics, then the description that they would write of the rules in that dialect would be every bit as complex, every bit as tricky as one would be of standard English. And that's not always obvious because we're trained to hear the things that black English lacks that standard English has, whereas in fact there are quite a few things that standard English lacks that black English has. And so during the Ebonics controversy, one of the things I wanted to do was to try to make it clear to as many people as I could that whatever your position on whether or not this dialect should be used in the classroom, that black English is not bad speech. And unfortunately, it's not as if I was the first person to do that, but most of the people who had stepped up to the plate on that issue were more concerned with expressing an idea that black English is part of black culture and therefore to reject black English is to reject black people. I don't think that that argument really convinces anybody. I think a lot of people come away from that argument thinking, well, black culture may be nice and vibrant. It's too bad they've got that broken down dialect. So I tried to use an argument where the dialect itself was analyzed. And I think some linguists are afraid to share with the public linguistic analysis. We're afraid that we won't be able to break it down or that we'll bore people. But I think if you really work at it, you can get it across.
Well, you just said that there are certain standards that black English has that standard English doesn't. That's an interesting contrast. Maybe you can give us an example.
Well, you know, one example of that is the use of be. Many of us listen to black English, and what we hear is this sad, unconjugated verb being thrown all over the place. But in fact, when a person says, I be walking to the store, What they mean is not that I'm walking to the store right now, but that I walk to the store on a regular basis, say, for example, every Tuesday, etc. It means that specific thing. If somebody stood at a window and pointed and said, "She be walking by," that would be non-native Black English. It would be clear that that person had not actually grown up in the culture. It would sound as off as saying something like "a boy good" as opposed to "a good boy" in standard English. This is the sort of thing that one is often not aware of. Many African-American speakers of Black English are not aware of that, just like we standard English speakers are not aware of a great many of the subtle things going on in our dialect. But standard English does not distinguish this kind of what's called habituality, the idea of doing something on a regular basis, in that overt kind of way. Some languages happen to indicate that sort of repetition in a very clear way. Some languages don't. Some dialects do. Some dialects don't. Standard English is kind of naked as far as that goes. You just have to kind of get it from context. I walk on Tuesdays. Black English actually has this be, and it's very systematic. You can, next time you're listening to Black English or standing in line and people are using the dialect behind you, listen to how that be is used. Never will it describe something going on right at the time. The be is always used to describe one's habits over time. Now, multiply that by a couple of dozen things, and Black English becomes a much more wondrous thing than we're used to thinking of it as.
Well, clearly you think that, Black English is very rich and very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that you think it should be used in the classroom or that classes should be taught in Ebonics?
Well, no, actually. There is obviously a serious problem with Black students in education, and for a long time there have been people who thought that perhaps there was a translation issue. But it immediately seemed to me that, first of all, throughout history, there have been a great many Black people from all circumstances whose home dialect was Black English who did very well in school, and also that it seemed to me that the issue was a larger cultural one. And so during the Ebonics controversy, that seemed obvious to me, and so I started saying it when, to my surprise, the media started calling me and asking me. And I found that I was the only African-American linguist who was taking that position. And that was an eye-opening experience for me, because I suppose it was my first immediate encounter with what happens when an African-American steps outside of a certain orthodoxy in their public statements.
What happened to you?
Well, I found that immediately I was getting angry emails and phone calls, and that various African-American linguists who were concerned with Black English were cutting me dead, which a couple of them continue to this day. And the problem was seen to be that I was going against an unspoken rule that African-American scholars and leaders are to stick up for Black victimhood when the cameras are rolling. I honestly had never had occasion to think about that before then, and this was the motivation for it.
What did you grow up speaking, both?
Well, that's an interesting question, Terry, because I grew up around it very much. It's what most of my family speaks, and good friends of mine spoke it. And yet, nevertheless, neither me nor my sister incorporated that dialect in any serious way. And it wasn't as if we were told at home not to speak that way. And even if we had been, the fact is that a great many Black parents tell their children not to use certain constructions and not to talk in certain ways. And it has no effect because speech is so deeply seated. Thinking about it over the years, it has occurred to me that I grew up in a home where my parents were, despite all the wonderful things about them, rather socially insular people. And there was a tacit message conveyed in our home that you are not like them. And them was not just Black people. Them was white people and everybody else. There was a sense that we were in our own little cocoon. No one actually said that, but you drink in subtle cues from your parents. And I think as a result, there was always a sense in me as well as in my sister, despite the fact that she is much more of a joiner than I am, that the way you talk is the way your teachers in school talk and the way you hear your parents talking. And it's a shame, unfortunately, because many African-Americans are viscerally put off by another African-American who doesn't have a certain what's often called Black sound. And I've often considered myself quite literally vocally handicapped by the fact that I don't really have the dialect. Because after a certain point, just as it's hard to learn another language in any native way after the age of about 13, you know, if you wake up and you're 25 years old and you don't have a dialect, if you try to use it, you're going to sound as fake as you would in trying to fake a good Russian accent or something like that. It's interesting. During the Ebonics controversy, one was often told that children who have Black English as a home language are handicapped because they face a different dialect in school. And I thought, yes, one could say that, but I've often myself felt equally handicapped in terms of not having that dialect when I am in Black culture and finding myself sticking out.
Were there even slang expressions that you wished you could use, but they sounded kind of fake in your mouth?
Yes. I can't say man. You know, I've tried and tried. It would be so nice if I could say, come on, have a drink with me, man. And I sound just like that. It's unfortunate. If I could get that one word, then I think I could take away about 25% of the problem, but it's just not there. I always sound like a 50-year-old white insurance salesman, and I'm just stuck with it.
My guest is linguist and writer John McWhorter. His books include Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, The Word on the Street, Fact and Fable About American English, and the new book, The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John McWhorter, author of the new book, The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language, and the book, Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America. Now you say you were a very good student, and I don't doubt that, when you were young, and that you really enjoyed learning, but that you found that academic achievement isn't valued by most African-American young people, and in fact, it can often be looked down on, that academic achievement is often seen as white. Now, other people have made that observation, too. What was it about your own personal experiences that led you to that observation?
My first experience with it was when I was 4 years old, maybe five, and some African-American kids in the neighborhood we had just moved into asked me to spell concrete, and I spelled it. And one of them had his little sister come up and slap me on the arm over and over again. And for some reason, I didn't run away. But the idea was that you were not supposed to spell. And of course, there is some of that even in mainstream white culture. But in Black culture, particularly in the teen years, there's a sense that you are really selling out, that you're kind of a traitor if you embrace school. Now, I actually personally did not get much more of that after that. I just kind of learned that when you're with Black kids, and I was very much when I was young, just as much as with white kids, that you kind of keep that sort of thing quiet. But I had friends that I made when I was a teen who were not aware of that, and I watched them being tortured and made fun of repeatedly. It's just very much in the air. And then you find, if you happen to look into the issue, that studies have been done that are noting that this is a problem. And very often it's thought of as, well, one of many things. And there's a very strong focus in the educational establishment and in graduate schools of education on attributing Black students' problems in school to racism and various shades of racism. Those people are very well-intentioned. But the fact is that if there is a very strong tendency, and I don't think anybody can deny that there is, for Black teens in particular to tease one another as acting white if they do well in school, why wouldn't that be a very important part of the problem? In fact, why wouldn't that be the dominant explanation? And so far, very few people have answered that question. Of course, there are funding discrepancies among schools, and that is not fair. But then on the other hand, there are a great many students in those very same horrible schools who do very well. These are students with a different culture than African Americans, and all that suggests is that we look to the culture in trying to solve the problem. Conversely, there are lushly funded schools with an incredible battery of supports for minority students in many suburbs in the United States, where, in fact, Black students still tend to cluster at the bottom. The solution there is not to blame black students, but if we're going to look for solutions to the problem, we can't keep looking to white racism as if it was still 1950. So that's the value in pointing out the acting white phenomenon. And it's something which I personally experienced very little of, but I certainly saw it going on with others. And I think that it's a very serious issue that we have to put a name on and think about sustainably if we really hope to make any difference in black, in lagging scores between black and white students.
I want to say something that you've already kind of acknowledged, and that is that, you know, it's usually not considered particularly cool for a white kid if they're smart. I mean, smart white kids are often really mocked for being smart, for getting good grades, or for studying.
Yeah, there is certainly the nerd syndrome, and that's an American,
probably
universal trope in American society, probably a human trait. But in African-American culture, there's more. It's one thing to be told you're a nerd. It's another thing to be told that you are acting white, that is, identifying with the oppressor, that is, thinking that you're better than other black people. And what one sees is that in many places, it turns not just some, but most black kids away from doing really well in school. So the idea is not to compare Holocaust, but there's a particular sting to it in black culture that I think has a disproportionate effect.
Why is it, do you think, that for some black teenagers, being smart or being interested in school, studying, is perceived as being white and therefore not a very good thing for a black person to do?
Well, this problem actually only traces back about 35 years. It's not inherent to black culture. It's something that starts in the late 60s with the post-civil rights, black power, ideological atmosphere. And where it came from, I believe, is a sense that came in black culture around that time, that white culture was an evil that it was no longer worth trying to integrate towards. The idea at this time was that integration was folly and that separatism was a better path. And, of course, there was some truth to that, and I think that that's made our discussion of race a lot richer in many ways than it was before the late 60s. However, it's not an accident that it's around that time, when the separatist current was at its strongest, that black kids begin teasing each other in that way. Before that, black kids were certainly teased for being nerds sometimes. My mother was teased for being a walking encyclopedia in Atlanta in the late 40s. But she wasn't teased for, quote-unquote, acting white. That's something that starts later. And I've even had people write to me since my book Losing the Race came out, which in part discussed this issue. And it's quite clear from the ages of the people that this is a phenomenon that started around 1966. And I even got one letter from somebody who said, quite unprompted by me, that they had never experienced this in school in the early 60s, but then they noticed that their cousins were running up against it in the late 60s. And I think that today, interracial relations are much better than they were in 1966. However, there is what I have called a virus, a certain sense of what a black identity is, which has passed from peer to peer to peer and has been over the past 35 years, which is that to excel in school is to be like the oppressor, to be like the people which we at 12 and 13 are in the process of defining ourselves against. And whatever you have to say about this sort of cultural self-definition, and one may have some good things to say about it, the fact is that I think it unfortunately condemns a lot of African-American students to scholarly failure, and I'd like to see that change.
Are there any solutions you've been thinking about?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's an ironic solution. Black children often can be weaned off of that acting white tendency. In small, all-minority schools, we see this across the United States, when you have a school with, you know, at most a few hundred students, most of them or all of them black, and you have teachers who are deeply committed and set high standards, then you see that there's a representative number of excellent black students, and a lot less of the idea that to do well in school is to step outside of your culture, because after all, in such schools, there are no white people to define yourself against. And so what this means is that as many African American students as possible should end up in such schools. And what that ends up meaning is that vouchers are a good idea. So for me, vouchers is not a matter of giving my allegiance to the Republican Party in return for some sort of favors later, etc. It's that as many black students as possible should be rescued from failing public schools, which, if they're ever going to not fail, are going to take at least 20 years to not do so, and put them into places where they can get a real education and develop a genuinely healthy, proud black identity by doing well in school without feeling guilty about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John McWhorter, and he's the author of several books. His new book is called The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. He's also the author of Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, and The Word on the Street, Fact and Fable About American English. He teaches linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. We've been talking about what you describe as a phenomenon in which African-American students sometimes see being a good student, achieving academically, being serious about school, as a white thing. And so they're reluctant to put too much value on school. And they see school itself as a kind of institution of the white oppressor. You think that this ties in with what you describe as the cult of victimology.
Ultimately, what this traces to is a tendency, which we've also seen in black culture predominantly only since the late 60s, which is to see victimhood at the hands of whites as one of the defining features of the African-American experience. And what it comes down to is something very simple. And that is a conviction, which we've seen particularly from the left in general since the 1960s, which says that a group cannot achieve in any meaningful way until racism, even in its residual forms, does not exist. That's something that we're often told actively and passively, particularly living in our moment. And yet that would have surprised a great many groups on the rise in the past. It would surprise a great many groups on the rise today, including very black immigrants from the Caribbean and Africa. And yet we're often told that for African Americans, until life is more or less perfect, until there are no biases, even of the most subtle nature, that African Americans are barred from achieving, or better, that only the occasional superstar will do so. And that is the definition of the cult of victimology. It's not that one should not call attention to one's victimhood if one is really being victimized. But it seems to me that once we've gotten rid of legalized discrimination, and then once we've also stomped out a great deal of the more overt kinds of spiritual racism, as you might call it, we've basically gotten about as far as we're going to go on that score. And it's time to start admitting that if we are a strong people, then we can achieve despite obstacles, even serious obstacles.
John McWhorter is the author of Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, and author of The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's touring with the World Trade Center Archive Project, a traveling State Department-sponsored exhibition of the photographs that he's taken at Ground Zero. And we continue our conversation with linguist John McWhorter. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with linguist and writer John McWhorter. His new book is called The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. He wrote about Ebonics in his book, The Word on the Street, Fact and Fable About American English. And he wrote about what he describes as the cult of victimology within the African-American community in his book, Losing the Race. He describes that cult as treating victimhood not as a problem to be solved, but as an identity to be nurtured. He says when he was young, he used victimology to explain some of his experiences.
One episode I remember is that back in, I suppose I would have been in ninth grade, and I had a loud voice, and we were in a study hall, and I kept on whispering to a friend of mine, and my version of whispering was pretty much speaking at a normal level for other people, and the proctor of the section, who was a white woman, made me sit out in the hall. Well, I was embarrassed, and she had done this in front of a girl I liked, and so I mumbled something about her just wanting to see white faces in front of her. Now, that felt really good because, of course, what can she say about that? And I can feel morally exalted, and it can detract me from the fact that, really, in that particular instance, I was just talking too darn loud. And there were all sorts of episodes like that. And in this, I was warmly supported by my African-American friends who was assumed that this way of thinking was even progressive, that these things are not immediately apparent, but if you can perceive this kind of subtle racism, then you're kind of one step ahead. But the fact of the matter is that life is rarely that simple, and that none of us are perfect, and that all of us benefit from looking at the ways that we're not perfect. And I'm the last one to claim that racism doesn't exist in America anymore, but I'm also the first one to claim that it is vastly less a problem than it was 40 years ago, and that most of the kind of racism that we experience today is the kind of thing that most people in the world face. When I think about victimology and arguing against the tacit idea that we are to think of ourselves as victims rather than as victors, I think to myself that racism of the kind that we're often encouraged to look at, people pulling their purses closer when black men walk by, subtle sorts of biases in terms of promotions, etc., there is not a country in the world where those sorts of things don't exist. That doesn't mean that it's okay, but that it means that our idea that here in the United States we're not going to have any of those things at all is quixotic, really. We're asking for something which is never going to happen, and we're asking for something which does not need to happen before black people can be the best that they can be.
I'm wondering if you thought things like this a long time before you said them publicly.
Wow. What an interesting question. Some of them, yes, although they were unformed, because the fact of the matter was that until the demise of racial preferences at Berkeley, these issues were not ones that I devoted myself to in any meaningful way. What I was a linguist. I did a whole lot more theater back then, and there are all sorts of other things that I do. But studying that particular problem led me to read around and to talk to various people. And as time has gone by, I found that my thoughts on these things were becoming more precise. And that's certainly been the case since Losing the Race came out. Nobody ever believes this when I say it, but I really didn't think that anybody was going to care what some anonymous linguist had to say about race in America. I figured that things rather like what I said had been said by a great many people before, that it would be old news. I just wrote the book to get my views out there. It was my fifth book. But all of a sudden, there was this attention that was paid, and I found myself being called upon to talk about these things. And I do find that my views on these things get clearer and clearer as time goes by. As a matter of fact, over the past year and a half, it's gotten to the point where the speech that I make out on the circuit about these things really has departed so much from Losing the Race that it practically would be worth a new book, although I really don't have it in me to write one right now.
What kinds of things are you thinking now that you weren't thinking when you wrote Losing the Race?
Well, for example, the point that I make about residual racism not being a condemnation to failure. I say that in Losing the Race, but I kind of dance around the subject because I hadn't realized how very important that was. Many people seem to misinterpret me as saying that there was no racism. And I think it's very clear in the book that I know that there's racism. I describe how I've experienced it in a rather extended section. But it occurred to me that the real issue is, why precisely are we focusing so much on racism in its subtle forms? And I realized that throughout my life, that had been my major ideological bone of contention with my black peers. Once this racism talk started coming in, my general feeling was, who cares? If I walk into a Woolworths and somebody follows me a little bit down one of the aisles because they think I'm going to steal something, frankly, it takes a lot more than that to ruin my day. And yet, for a great many African Americans I knew, things like that were worth sounding the alarm. I finally realized that that kind of dialogue was much, much sparser in black America before the Black Power movement, and I started to feel that that predominance today is a departure rather than progress. So that's one of the things that I have thought about more.
Now, I have to admit a certain awkwardness as a white person interviewing you about these subjects. I feel if I'm not very challenging to you, that some listeners might think, well, sure, it would be easy for her to be accepting this because as a white person, what you are saying lets me off the hook. Because if racism isn't really the issue, and if therefore white people aren't really the problem, then you know, I'm absolved of any possible wrongdoing.
Sure. As far as I'm concerned, an individual white person is absolved of wrongdoing to the extent that they are conscious of the evil of institutionalized discrimination, to the extent that they're conscious that there's a such thing as systemic racism, and to the extent that they work on themselves in terms of trying to purge themselves of racism as much as possible. My view is that most educated, in particular, white Americans have gone about as far as they can go on this realistically, and I think that most whites in America have. As far as society is concerned, I firmly believe that the government has a responsibility to assist African Americans, partly because of our history in this country and partly because of the reality of the ideological currents that I've talked about, which we may not like, but which are not going to go away just by people writing op-eds saying that they're not a good idea. But we have to realize what people can do to get themselves off of the hook as opposed to what actually leaves them on it. So, for example, open-ended welfare, that left white people on the hook. Welfare reform, if intelligently done, that gets white people off of the hook. Affirmative action, where it's overdone, where it takes underqualified people and puts them in positions where they not only make black people look incompetent, but also are emotionally destroyed themselves. As far as I'm concerned, that kind of affirmative action leaves white people on the hook. Affirmative action where there's a search made for qualified people, and such people are supported in their efforts as much as possible, well, for me, that leaves white people off of the hook, even if such a search does not necessarily create a 13% black workforce or student body. We live in a society here. So that is a rich issue. I don't think that white people are completely absolved, but I think that the absolution will come much more from general governmental efforts than from things going on in individual interactions. As far as I'm concerned, you're not a strong person if you genuinely believe that the minute you sense any kind of bias from someone in an individual interaction, you are spiritually destroyed as a human being. That's a very disempowering message, and African Americans have been taught to believe it for far too long.
You first published your book, Losing the Race, in 2000.
That's right.
And that's when you started publicly saying the kinds of things that you've been saying on Fresh Air today.
That's
right. I'm wondering if you have become any more or less controversial since the book was first published. In other words, whether you find more African Americans agreeing with you or strongly disagreeing with you.
Oh, agreeing. Actually, one of the biggest myths about that book and me is that I am hunkered down in my living room, having been threatened and screamed at and rejected by the black establishment. Not at all. Actually, I have gotten so much love mail from Losing the Race over the past year and a half that I barely know what to do with it. Literally, at least once every few days, an African-American person stops me on the street and tells me how much they like the book or an appearance that I made somewhere where I expressed its ideas. I actually think that most African-Americans agree with what's in that book. For whatever it's worth, I'm really not that far to the right. And I think that most of the things in that book are certainly not a matter of genius. It's just a kind of common sense that we've often been detracted from. There are a certain number of people in black academia, particularly in humanities and the social sciences, who naturally don't like a book like Losing the Race. But really, the humanities and the social sciences, or specifically the black people who work in them, And then people who work in schools of education and the graduate students there and some school teachers, that's only a tiny sliver of the African-American community.
Well, John McWhorter, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
John McWhorter is the author of Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America, and The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. Coming up, photographer Joel Meyerowitz, who is touring the world with an exhibition of his pictures of Ground Zero. This is Fresh Air. Today marks the six-month anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. It's a day of remembrance, dedications, moments of silence, and prayers. Photographer Joel Meyerowitz has been creating an archive of his photos taken at Ground Zero, documenting the aftermath of the attack and the process of recovery. He started going to Ground Zero just a few days after the attacks, received a special permit to take pictures there, and has been spending several days a week there ever since. He's creating an archive of his Ground Zero photos for the Museum of the City of New York. Some of those photos are now touring the world in an exhibition sponsored by the State Department Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and the museum. Meyerowitz left New York to tour with the exhibition 1 week ago. Before we hear from him, let's listen back to a brief excerpt of the interview we recorded last October. He described the view the night of September 24th, when he walked through and climbed the stairs of the World Financial Center, which was opposite the South Tower.
In every place that we passed, you could see the record of flight, which was, in some way, what it reminded me of was Pompeii. When you go to Pompeii and you see what happened when the lava came down and stopped people in the ordinariness of their lives, you know, now all is revealed in some way. And this dust encrusting everything showed you, you know, books that were open and wallets left on desks and people's possessions, their coats, whatever they left behind when they fled was all there, encrusted in this, entombed in this dust. The roof itself was littered in about a foot deep of papers and chairs and pieces of metal that had flown off of the World Trade Center. The cladding, the aluminum cladding, went flying through the air and wound up in these ribbon masses. Venetian blinds and curtains And I came across, it was a bottle of, some mineral water, and it was standing upright. I mean, and where did it come from? It must have flown out of some window and landed vertical in this mass. But when I got to the edge and I looked down, it was lit as if by stadium lighting. So you could see the masses of metal just dripping over every structure that was there was this spaghetti-like, bird's nest-like, swamp-like mess of wiring and metal. And I tell you, it takes your breath away.
Photographer Joel Meyerowitz recorded last October. He's now touring with the State Department-sponsored exhibition of his Ground Zero photos. This week, the show is opening in Rome, Dar es Salaam, Panama, and Paris. It's already opened in London, Manila, and Istanbul. I called him in Istanbul on Friday and asked him to describe some of his recent Ground Zero photos.
The image that seems to be the most iconic one for me and the most consistent one is that of the fireman with a rank. Sometimes you see three or four men standing there. They look like shepherds, leaning on their staffs. And the grappler comes along and grabs a mouthful of stuff and sifts it for them. And the firemen walk in and start raking, hoping to look for or find a purse, a shoe, a ring, something that might identify the remains of someone and give some comfort to a family. I did see, just about 10 days ago, the discovery of $11 million in cash from the Bank of America's vault on the 11th floor of the North Tower. They found it four stories below ground, and it was burst open. And the image was almost a surreal one. It was dusk, and there were about 12 policemen lying and sitting in the rubble, reaching in and pulling out fistfuls of dollars and yen and lira and stuffing it into laundry bags. And there was something about it that was almost hilarious, the way these guys were going about it. They each had a cigar, chomping on a cigar and stuffing money in bags.
Did you get photos
of
that?
Yeah, I photographed all of the discovery, and then finally all dozen police officers held the bags up against their chests, proudly displaying $11 million worth of money that they had to trade in real fast while before the euro was completely established.
Is there anything you find most surprising about how the site of the World Trade Center has been transformed ever since September 13th when you got there?
I think what's amazing to me about the whole place is the determination on the part of everyone who works in there, the devotion that they show about cleaning the site out and making it ready or completing it so that the next time they can begin to build, the site has had some peace in it. It has gone from a smoking pile six stories high to this vast empty space, which is astonishing to stand on the edge of and look across.
How did the State Department decide to tour an exhibit of your photos?
Well, you could say that your program is responsible for that. So many people heard our interview, and someone at the State Department picked up on it and thought that these photographs might be just the thing for them to tour, as they said, to our friends and enemies alike. And so I was contacted by Brian Sexton of the State Department, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and he came to visit with Undersecretary Harrison and staff. And they looked at lots of the work from the first 2 months only. And together we chose 27 photographs. And they're now going out around the world to 27 different countries.
Now, you said the State Department thought that this would be good to tour to our friends and enemies. What are they hoping this exhibit will do for our enemies?
I think that what they anticipate is that by showing that this event really happened, that there is the aftermath, that it wasn't some Hollywood, fake, that it will show people that we suffer too, and that we're recovering from this, and that there are people who are humanitarian in the way that they're going about repairing the damage.
As we record this, you're in Istanbul, Turkey. Turkey's an Islamic country. This is the first Islamic country that this exhibit has gone to. What kind of questions are you being asked about the show?
Well, so far, they've been softball questions that really are about what were my emotions like down there, what does the site make me, think of, how has it affected people in New York? There have been no political questions, and I haven't been given any protocols on the part of the State Department in ways to answer anything. It's been a relatively free-handed relationship.
Are you expecting somebody to say to you, well, sure, we don't really quite believe the story because it was actually a Jewish conspiracy? Didn't you hear that no Jew showed up at the World Trade Center that day? And by the way, Joel Meyerowitz, isn't that a Jewish name? Are you expecting to hear that?
I would imagine that that would be possible in the Islamic countries. It certainly wasn't a question I received in London at all through the various correspondents that interviewed me, but it wouldn't surprise me here.
What are the photographs that are getting the biggest response so far?
The photographs that people are astonished by the complexity of the pile, but frankly, it's the human activity down there, the collections of men who are searching in the rubble or relaxing after their work. And one single image of a fireman who was wounded on the day of the attack and who's come back in a wheelchair, and he's rolled himself up to a barricade and he's looking over the barricade into the pile. And something in his posture tells it all. And for some reason, that picture gets people kind of weepy.
My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's traveling to several countries with a State Department-sponsored exhibition of his photos of Ground Zero. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's been documenting life at Ground Zero ever since a few days after the attacks. He's now traveling to several countries with a State Department exhibition of his photos. We called him Friday in Istanbul. The first time we spoke about your photos at Ground Zero, you told us that a search and rescue team had taken you under their wing and that they were helping get you to kind of secretive hidden places within Ground Zero that were hard to get access to. What's your relationship with them now?
Interestingly enough, we speak to each other almost daily. They've been removed from their work at Ground Zero because they're needed elsewhere in Manhattan and New York. They are the arson and explosion squad, so they're constantly being challenged in other ways. But we talk to each other by cell phone almost every day, and two of them came with me to Washington last week and were cited by Colin Powell for their efforts in Ground Zero and for their making the whole job possible for me. So, in fact, I think one of them is being sent on part of the tour down to South America.
Are you worried about having inhaled fumes for so long? Because you, like the firefighters who were there and the other rescue workers, have just been inhaling a lot of fumes from the burning pile.
Yes, I am concerned somewhat about my own health. I mean, in the early days, the masks that were given out were not the most protective ones. And there was a tendency on clear, fresh days to take it off because working with it on for 4 or 5 hours at a time was terrible. I mean, you just were sweating inside of it. It was actually hard to breathe. Got dizzy sometimes. So I certainly took it off. But, you know, I wasn't there on a round-the-clock basis the way some of those other workers were there. I mean, I know guys who were there 50 days straight, spending 10, 12 hours a day. And every one of them, when they were removed from the site, got sick one way or another, mostly respiratory illnesses.
Yeah. Well, you've been at Ground Zero since September. And now you're touring to cities around the world with the exhibit of your photos from Ground Zero. I'm wondering what it's like for you to be going to all these other cities after having been focused for so long on the rubble at Ground Zero.
Well, I think that taking the break is a welcome change. And yet, here today in Istanbul, we were met by a bunch of people from the embassy of Turkish descent, and they were telling us about the earthquake 2 years ago that killed 40,000 people and how the efforts to recover the dead there, you know, reminded them of what we've been going through in New York. So here was a chance to share in national tragedy in a surprising way. I hadn't expected that. And also, interesting to say sharing, because in London, the Museum of the City of London put up a show adjacent to mine of the Blitz photographs from World War II. And they were so incredibly close to my photographs. Same attending to the dead, the same hosing down the smoking structures. I mean, it was eerie in a few instances to see that the photographs were almost exactly the same.
Well, Joel, I wish you good travels with your exhibit, safe travels, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Photographer Joel Marowitz, an exhibition of his photos of Ground Zero, is traveling to several countries in a tour sponsored by the State Department Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and the Museum of the City of New York. Our talk was recorded Friday from Istanbul, where his exhibit has already opened. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from the new CD, Wish You Were Here, a collection of love songs for New York. This is Ari Up.
Hey, this is Ari. I'm here to say the New York tragedy affected me in a very personal way. My 7-year-old son grew up admiring the towers. On that very same week of September 11th, I was going to take him sightseeing in the towers.
Mommy.
Big up, New York!
Don't say nothing bad about New York.
Oh, no.
Don't say nothing bad about my city.
I love it so.
Don't say nothing bad about New York.
Don't you know?
Don't say nothing bad about my city.
It's good.
It's good.
It's good to me.
Good to me.
It's all I care about.
Don't say nothing bad about Brooklyn.
Oh, no.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Love, Greg and Lauren, a husband's day-by-day account of his wife's remarkable recovery. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the current sexual abuse scandals and other crises facing the priesthood with Father Donald Cousins, author of The Changing Face of the Priesthood, a reflection on the priest's crisis of soul. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.